Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, January 7th, 2006. Today, just a few days before both anti- and pro-death penalty bills in New Hampshire will be considered at legislative hearings, Making Waves features an interview with Michael Mello, death penalty defense attorney who has served as counselor at law in over 70 capital punishment cases. Interviewed by Tom Jackson, he talks about Tookie Williams' case and his own experiences as a death penalty defense attorney. Our second hour will bring you dispatches from Prison Radio's Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from death row. Following that, we'll hear commentary by Palestinian-American and former Yale professor Mazen Kumsia about Palestine, Israel, Sharon, and the media. Also, for our first show of the new year, a new feature entitled Extreme News will come after our mid-show break, and we will end the show with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Connecticut. We'll also have music, announcements, and more. First, we bring you some news.
This week, we bring you news summaries collected through the Radio for All network.
This is In the News for January 3rd, 2006. I'm Scott Berguin of KSOW-LP in Cottage Grove, Oregon. First story today is a bit of a breaking news story from Reuters, dated today, January 3rd, out of Baiji, Iraq. U.S. air raid kills Iraqi family, according to officials, and I will add that this is a disastrous example of what we're being told is a major increase in U.S. use of air power, bombing of Iraq, and people being concerned that many more civilians than have already been being killed will, that number will increase. So here's a story again from Reuters out of Baiji, Iraq. A U.S. airstrike killed several members of a family in the oil refining town of Baiji in northern Iraq, Iraqi security forces said on Tuesday. The U.S. military, responding to an inquiry, said aircraft had targeted a house after three men suspected of planting a roadside bomb were seen entering the building late on Monday. The military statement made no mention of casualties and said Iraqi police had handled the scene after the attack. Local people at the scene of the blast said seven bodies were recovered from the rubble, including at least two children. A police official in the regional capital, Tikrit, said six people were killed and three wounded, although an official at the Joint Coordination Center, which liaises between U.S. and Iraqi forces in Salalah Hadin province, said 14 died. Officials named the householder as Gadhan Nahi Hussein. A statement from the U.S. 101st Airborne Division in response to an inquiry about the death said soldiers monitoring video footage from a reconnaissance drone spotted three men apparently digging a hole around 9 p.m., quote, following the common pattern of roadside bomb emplacement, end quote. Bomber pilots were alerted, the military statement said, and went on, quote, the individuals left the roadside and were followed from the air to a nearby building. Coalition forces employed precision-guided munitions on the structure, end quote. The statement did not say whether a roadside bomb was found. Baji has seen considerable rebel attacks, including efforts by insurgents to disrupt oil and fuel flows through its refinery, the biggest in Iraq. The closure of the refinery last month has caused serious shortages in fuel across the country, although the plant reopened again late on Monday. U.S. forces have used air power increasingly throughout the past year. Official military data show only one strike was carried out in March, and the average in the first quarter was five strikes per month, compared to over 50 in the last quarter. Iraqi medical staff, police, and political leaders, particularly in the restive Sunni Arab-dominated West and North, have reported civilian casualties in such raids. U.S. commanders say they make every effort to minimize the risk. There's information on this for Reuters. Gained additional reporting was by Arif Mohammed in Kirkuk, Kaswan al-Jabouri in Tikrit, and Asil Kami, Alistair MacDonald, Gideon Long, and Hiba Musa in Baghdad. Again, that's from Reuters. Next story today is from the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, or CISPAS. It's a press release dated December 29th. Roadblocks thwart January 1st CAFTA deadline. Stop CAFTA Coalition announces actions to protest faulty undemocratic implementation process for Central American Free Trade Agreement. In January, local groups around the country will mobilize to protest the implementation of the U.S. Dominican Republic Central American Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, passed in the U.S. House of Representatives by a mere 2 votes in July after a draining political battle. July 1, 2006 marks the date that the Bush administration had set for implementation of CAFTA. However, progress has been frustrated in various countries where the U.S. insists on the need for constitutional reforms before CAFTA goes into effect, while in Costa Rica, the parliament has yet to bring CAFTA to a vote, despite recent threats from the U.S. ambassador. According to Kristen Baker, a spokesperson for the U.S. trade representative, quote, "We want CAFTA, Dominican Republic, to start as close as possible to January 1, 2006, so that U.S. and regional businesses can begin taking advantage of the agreement's benefits in the shortest possible time," end quote. But even in El Salvador, the country closest to finalizing its constitutional reforms, President Tony Saca has announced that conflicts within the Salvadoran Assembly will prevent implementation until at least February. The Bush administration continues to push reforms to the remaining country's domestic laws before they can comply with the broad changes that CAFTA imposes. Tom Ricker of the Quixote Center of the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador said, quote, "The problems associated with implementing CAFTA demonstrate what we've been saying all along. This agreement goes beyond trade in requiring dramatic changes in domestic laws that grant new rights to transnational corporations at the expense of working people," end quote. He continued, "The fact that legislatures throughout Central America and in the Dominican Republic are now struggling to change laws governing intellectual property, services, and investment in order to receive U.S. certification for joining CAFTA makes clear the undemocratic nature of this agreement," end quote. According to Burke Stansbury from the Committee in Solidarity with the People of El Salvador, quote, "From day one, the Bush administration has been trying to ram CAFTA down people's throats with little substantive debate and despite voices of tremendous opposition. In Costa Rica, they have failed, and in other countries it took repression and dirty tactics to ratify CAFTA. But just as Central American social movements continue to resist the imposition of the devastating agreement, we too are not giving up," end quote. Organizations from throughout Central America recently met in Costa Rica for the 5th Mesoamerican Forum, where they pledged to continue fighting CAFTA and to mobilize huge protests for the visit of President Bush to El Salvador in mid-January. In the U.S., the Stop CAFTA Coalition is organizing coordinated local anti-CAFTA actions in January to denounce the likely effects of the agreement in Central America and to hold accountable representatives and senators who voted in favor of CAFTA in July. For more information on this issue, go to www.stopcafta.org. And finally today, from High Country News, there's a section called Hotlines. This is from their latest issue. You can find High Country News at hcn.org. This is titled "Bipartisan Uprising Sinks Public Lands Sell-Off." A proposal to sell public lands landed in the trash can on December 13th, thanks to objections from Western senators, both Democrat and Republican. Representative Jim Gibbons, Republican of Nevada, and Representative Richard Pombo, Republican of California, had tried to overturn an 11-year moratorium on selling federal land to mining companies by attaching a proposal to House budget legislation. Critics said the provision would have allowed developers to buy millions of acres of public land for as little as $1,000 per acre. The Pombo-Gibbons proposal immediately sparked a grassroots uprising. The leaders of more than 700 hunting groups, shooting and archery clubs, and conservation groups came out against the provision. They persuaded many politicians to condemn it, including Democratic congressmen and Republicans such as Senator Conrad Burns of Montana, Senator Craig Thomas of Wyoming, and Senator Wayne Allard of Colorado. Senator Thomas said, quote, "The mining provision never belonged in the budget reconciliation package," end quote. People like Joel Gossett of Platteville, Colorado, a Republican gun rights advocate and an avid hunter, are delighted with the provision's withdrawal. He said, quote, "I grew up in Colorado, and I can name 100 places where I can no longer camp," end quote, because private landowners closed off access. Gossett says that makes the public land increasingly important, he says. It belongs to the citizens of this country. It's the ultimate property rights issue. But the issue is far from settled. A spokesman for Pombo said he and Gibbons will try again next year to, quote-unquote, modernize the 1872 mining law that was written by Ray Ring of High Country News at hcn.org. www.ntinfo.org. This has been In the News for January 3rd, 2006. Talk to you next time.
Tell me the story of the great gray gold from this high country town in Colorado. Tell me of the moly that around the world is sold from this high country town in Colorado. Steel, metal, alloy for the tanks and the planes to fuel the Allied effort in the war. 2,000 pounds of raw crushed ore for 5 or so pounds of the moly. And they dug for the moly in the Climax mine. 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 At 11,000 feet above the sea, in the snow curtain of the Central Rockies, she is hard rock mineral ice, melts at 4,730 degrees. In the world's largest underground mine, open cast pits scar the mountains tall. In the wake of the Bonanza West and the Lonesome Pines, not for silver or gold, but a gold that doesn't shine. And they dug for the moly in the Climax mine. 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 Price that must truly be paid, oh what is the lesson to be learning? With tailings left in poison ponds and the sweat of 10,000 men's earnings. But is it any worse than what's general now in the boom towns of the New West? Endless development, resort, recreation, meet the New West, same as the Old West, where they dug for the moly in the Climax mine. 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 Well, night is falling, another day is done, and the moon, she tastes sweet in Leadville, shining ghostly on the frozen snow over Matchless Telluride and St. Elmo. There's a fire that burns in those who love the mountains, a restless heart beating in our ribs. The coyotes call for us to come away to a place where wildness lives, a place where wildness lives. So tell me the story of the great gray gold from this high country town in Colorado. Tell me of the moly that around the world is sold from this high country town in Colorado, where they dug for the moly in the Climax mine. Dug for the moly in the Climax mine. Dug for the moly in the Climax mine. Dug for the moly in the Climax mine.
That was Casey Neal with Moly. On Tuesday, January 10th, two bills, one to abolish and one to expand use of the death penalty in New Hampshire, will be considered at legislative hearings in Concord. HB 1422 would abolish executions and instead substitute life imprisonment for those crimes now punishable by death. A similar bill passed in 2000, only to be vetoed by Governor Gene Shaheen. HB 1292 would go in the opposite direction by making it possible for the state to execute everyone convicted of first-degree murder. With these hearings, and with recent high-profile death penalty cases in the news in mind, we hear from Michael Mello, who has served as counselor at law in over 70 capital punishment cases. He'll talk with Tom Jackson about the Tookie Williams case and his own experiences as a death penalty defense attorney.
For Joe Public Media, I'm Tom Jackson. And I will be talking today with Professor Michael Mello, who is an authority on the death penalty. In the past few weeks, the death penalty has been discussed in the media and publicly at a level not seen for quite some time. The execution in California of Tukey Williams was protested by many, and Kenneth Lee Boyd became the 1,000th person to be executed in the United States since the death penalty was reinstated back in 1976. Joining us today to talk about the death penalty is Professor Michael Mello. He teaches at Vermont Law School, and he's a specialist on the death penalty and has served as counselor at law on more than 50 capital punishment cases, including some very high-profile cases. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
Start off, if you would, by telling us about some of the cases that you've worked on.
Well, back in my youth, when I was a capital public defender in Florida during the early mid-1980s, I represented Ted Bundy, the fairly infamous accused serial killer. I was also involved, although I didn't actually represent Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber. And I've been involved in one court or another in most of the interesting and landmark capital punishment issues. I filed a friend of the court brief, for example, last year in Roper v. Simmons, the case where the U.S. Supreme Court this last March outlawed capital punishment for juvenile offenders. I was also the point person in Florida for litigating claims of race discrimination based on social science data, statistical data. So in all, probably around 70 cases, give or take.
Do you ever get the question, this is a little bit of an aside, but do you ever get the question, how can you defend these people? And if so, what's your response to that?
I get that question all the time. It's a question that I've been getting since I first started doing death penalty work, which actually started during my judicial clerkship from the summer of 82 to the summer of 83, when I clerked for a federal court of appeals judge named Robert Vance in Birmingham, Alabama. And there, I wasn't representing death row prisoners, but I was Judge Vance's death clerk, his phrase, which I've always found somewhat delicious. Then the question was, how can you even work on these cases as a law clerk? And I never really came up with a good, pithy, cocktail party conversation patter answer. The standard answer is that everyone, no matter how hideous, no matter what they've done, deserves a good lawyer, deserves their day in court. It's the American way. That answer has never really been entirely satisfactory to me, because it doesn't really answer the question, well, why you? I mean, why have you chosen to devote your professional life to representing people who commit the worst, most horrific crimes in America? And for me, it really happened by accident, if one believes in accidents. As I mentioned, I ended up being Judge Vance's death clerk for the year that I clerked in Alabama. And towards the end of my clerkship, I decided that it would be good to spend a year or so, and that's really all I planned on doing, spending a year or so representing death row prisoners in Florida to, honestly, to expiate some of the liberal guilt that I had acquired during my clerkship with Judge Vance. I ended up being assigned to write an opinion, a first draft of an opinion for the judge, affirming the conviction and death sentence for a profoundly mentally retarded African-American indigent poor person pauper named Ivan Ray Stanley. And that's a case that I still have nightmares about. So I went to Florida, found out that I loved the work, loved the people I was working with, and with a couple of exceptions, liked my clients and got along very well with them. So a year became two, became three, became four. And after a couple of years in private practice in Washington, D.C., where I spent about a third of my time working on the firm's pro bono death penalty cases, I relocated up here to Vermont. Vermont at Vermont Law School, and I've been writing and teaching capital punishment ever since.
Well, what's your take on a case that has been in the news a pretty fair amount the last month or so? Stanley Tukey Williams, founder of the Los Angeles-based gang, the Crips, convicted of murdering four people in California. Based on what you know about his case, do you think that he should have gotten clemency?
Clemency is one of those weird and really the last vestige of the divine right of kings. There are no standards. There are no guidance, no real guidelines. There's no judicial review. Governors can grant or decline or deny clemency based on whatever reason they want. Had I been governor of California, I would have granted clemency. I would have granted clemency to anyone whose case came before me, which is probably why I will probably never become governor of California or any other state. Williams was, in a lot of ways, a terrible case to become such a high-profile poster boy for capital punishment and clemency. He had done a lot of good things and good works during his time on death row, but even a lot of that was somewhat ambiguous and somewhat ambivalent, it always seemed to me. He never really took responsibility or admitted his guilt for the four murders for which he was executed. He never helped the police by providing information that might have been useful in closing other murder cases, in dismantling the Crips gang that he helped found. So on balance, for me, I never really thought that it was a terribly strong case for clemency. And I really don't know enough about the specifics of his trials or appeals to have an opinion on whether his trial was fair or whether he should have gotten a retrial. On its face, in my experience, if a capital case is clean enough to survive review by the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, as Williams was, then my guess is that there's not much fundamentally wrong with your case legally or constitutionally. The Ninth Circuit is widely and justifiably, for the most part, considered the most liberal and the most death row friendly circuit court in the country. So if they said that Tukey Williams' convictions and death sentences passed constitutional muster, my guess is that they probably did.
Well, going back to the if you were governor scenario for a second, you know, there was quite a reaction that came out, particularly in the progressive media, of people who are against the death penalty and or were against Tukey Williams being executed. There were lots of accusations that Governor Schwarzenegger, you know, was playing politics, and that's why he didn't give Tukey Williams clemency. What's your take on that? Is that something that, you know, is politics something that's played when we're talking about ending a person's life in a case like this?
I do. And of all of the hats that I have worn over the years as a lawyer and an advocate for death row, clemency was the process that I liked the least precisely because it was so politically driven and driven by forces and factors external to and really having next to nothing to do with the underlying fairness of the conviction or the death sentence. It's interesting. Clemency in this country used to be a fairly robust institution up until the late 60s. And interestingly, the last governor to grant a clemency in California was Ronald Reagan back in 1967. Since then, clemency has virtually ceased to exist, except in those rare cases in which there really is a genuine doubt about guilt. Questions of innocence, issues of innocence, really have become the center of gravity in not just the challenges to individual cases and capital punishment in the courts, but in the larger political context as well. I had actually held out some hope that Schwarzenegger might relent and do the right thing, from my perspective, do the right thing in the Williams case, especially since you really seem to be agonizing over it during the weekend. But at the end of the day, I think it would have been politically, I think, difficult for him to have granted clemency. For Schwarzenegger, given the fact that the voters of California just handed him his head with the four ballot initiatives that he'd been pushing. The politically safe decision, the path of least resistance for him, I think, would have been to deny clemency. So it's not surprising to me that he did, but it is a little disappointing. It would have been a great opportunity, I think, for him to do something based on principle that would have been unpopular among a good portion of his base, but which I think would have given him some real moral capital, which he might have been able to translate into political capital. But we'll never know, because he wimped out.
Mm-hmm. Well, in another recent execution that got actually significantly less attention than Tukey Williams, execution number 1,000 since the death penalty was reinstated in 1976 just took place. Kenneth Lee Boyd was executed in North Carolina.
Yep.
And that actually was something that got significantly less attention in the media than Tukey Williams, but nonetheless a sort of landmark, if you want to call it that. Your thoughts on that?
In some ways, it's just another execution. There was nothing really magical about the number 1,000, nothing intrinsically significant about the number 1,000, and until a couple of days before it actually happened, it looked like actually number 1,000 was going to be a Virginia death row prisoner named Robin Lovett, who got a commutation at the last minute from the governor of Virginia because the state had disposed of the murder weapon, a pair of scissors, in that case, which, had it not been disposed of, could have provided DNA information that would have cleared Lovett. Boyd was in some ways typical, in some ways not typical. It brought back some fairly unpleasant memories for me because Boyd was a Vietnam vet, came back from Vietnam. He drove a bulldozer, was sniped at almost every day that he was over there. And what it brought back to me was flashbacks of actually execution number 56, a Florida death row prisoner who I represented in 1986 named David Livingston Funchess, who was actually the first Vietnam veteran to be executed in the U.S. But milestones, you know, the 1,000th execution, the 2,000th American combat fatality in Iraq, don't really have intrinsic significance, it seems to me, but they do provide good teachable moments, sort of moments, an opportunity to go back and reflect on some of these larger questions. And 2005 actually was a milestone year in a number of different ways, in addition to the 1,000th execution.
Well, I want to bring things a little bit closer to home now and maybe talk about the death penalty in New Hampshire and also in Vermont. That I heard you say earlier that there is no death penalty statute in Vermont. Is that, did I hear that correctly?
There is no death penalty statute in Vermont, at least for the moment. The Vermont legislature all but abolished capital punishment in 1965. In 1972, the U.S. Supreme Court invalidated every state's death penalty statute in the U.S. in a magnificent constitutional earthquake of a case called Furman versus Georgia. And in the wake of Furman, 38 states have reinstated capital punishment, have enacted modern capital statutes, including New Hampshire, in, I think, 92 or 93. The Vermont legislature went the other way, actually. In 1987, the legislature abolished capital punishment, even though there really wasn't anything on the books to abolish. They just wanted to make clear that Vermont was a state that was not going to have the death penalty. And for a number of years now, we've been one of only 12 states that don't have capital punishment. In 2000, the year 2000, there was an especially hideous murder, actually a series of murders in Vermont. Two guys named Lee and Donnie Fell went on a rampage in the home in Vermont of Fell's mother and her companion. They killed both of them, escaped, hitchhiked to a Price Chopper supermarket in Rutland, Vermont, carjacked a woman named Tereska King at about 2 in the morning as Tereska King was arriving for work at the Price Chopper, carjacked her car, drove around 700 miles, I think, to Dutchess County, New York, and beat her to death by the side of the road as she was praying and pleading for her life. The state jurisdictions involved New York state prosecutors and Vermont state prosecutors, both decided for sort of independent and pretty interesting reasons, actually, if you want to spend some time talking on this, but they decided to punt it to the feds because under the federal carjacking statute, the federal prosecutors, the U.S. attorney in Vermont, could seek the death penalty. Problem was the U.S. attorney in Vermont decided, recommended against seeking the death penalty. The case went to the Ashcroft Justice Department in D.C., who overruled the Vermont federal prosecutor and insisted on prosecuting the Fell case as a death penalty case. And the upshot of all that was that last July, July of 2005, a Vermont federal jury in Chittenden County in Burlington found Donnie Fell guilty of the federal crime of carjacking with death resulting and sentenced him to death, which in Vermont was, there hasn't been a capital trial, much less a death sentence in Vermont in several generations of Vermont lawyers and judges. No one's been executed in Vermont since two killers went to the electric chair in 1954. The last time anyone was sentenced to death in Vermont was, I think, 1957, and that sentence was later commuted. And the last time anyone had even stood trial on capital charges in Vermont was 1962. So this has been a fairly unsettling set of circumstances here in Vermont. And it turns out that the Donnie Fell trial and the death sentence were probably just act one of this play. There is what, to all appearances at least, appears to be a very serious effort within the Vermont legislature to at least consider reinstating a state death penalty statute here. A relatively high-octane member of the Vermont House of Representatives, Duncan Kilmartin, has drafted a bill and is going to be introducing it probably on the first day of the Vermont legislative session. So the death penalty fireworks here really are just beginning. Stay tuned.
On this, the fireworks in New Hampshire have sort of died down, but a few years ago, of course, there was a pretty highly noted case in terms of trying to get our then Governor Jeanne Shaheen to agree to get the rest of the death penalty that's still on the books off of there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
We came so close in 2000. Both houses of the New Hampshire legislature, both Republican houses, Republican-controlled houses, of the New Hampshire legislature voted in a fairly lopsided, although not veto-proof way, to abolish capital punishment in Vermont, in New Hampshire, to repeal New Hampshire's state death penalty statute. It was, of course, vetoed by Democratic Governor Jeanne Shaheen, and it has, so far as I know, has been fairly, things have been pretty quiet there since then. I was invited to submit a statement to the New Hampshire legislature back in 2000, I think before the House Judiciary Committee. And there was a lot of hope and a lot of enthusiasm that New Hampshire might actually become the first state in the modern era of capital punishment since the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the boards back in 1972 with Furman v. Georgia to actually affirmatively abolish capital punishment. And we came within one vote of that, so close, but unfortunately the one vote was the governor. So New Hampshire still has an untested capital statute on the books. There's never been a capital prosecution under that statute that has resulted in a trial. There have been a couple of false starts, but they've both been resolved by guilty pleas before going to trial. But my hope is that as part of what seems to me, And this may just be wishful thinking on my part, but I think there's more to it than this. The rest of the country really seems to be reconsidering capital punishment in fundamental ways and is having a very serious, sophisticated, grown-up conversation about whether capital punishment is wise social policy, whether the benefits of capital punishment are worth the costs. And nothing would please me more than for the Vermont legislature to have a serious conversation, legislative hearings, bring in witnesses, really explore the issue in a serious way and in a comprehensive way in January of 2006, and then reject it resoundingly and for a generation. And the only thing that would make me happier than that would be if the New Hampshire legislature were then to follow suit and finally get rid of New Hampshire's capital punishment statute, which really is, it seems to me, mostly pointless. It has symbolic value, I suppose, but I'm not sure that it has much more than that.
You're listening to WSCALP 106.1 FM in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. I'm Tom Jackson, and for Joe Public Media, I am talking with Professor Michael Mello of Vermont Law School. He is a specialist on the death penalty. Mike, the death penalty is an issue that certainly draws some pretty strong opinions in people. Anytime that I've talked to folks about where they stand on the death penalty, I don't tend to get sort of wishy-washy answers. They're either very for it or very against it, it seems. Give us, from your perspective as a specialist on this issue, give us the basics of your best legal and moral arguments against the death penalty.
That's actually probably a harder question for me than it should be, because my opposition to capital punishment really isn't based on morality or religion or philosophy in a large sense. What I oppose is capital punishment as a legal system. It's a government operation. It's really the IRS with the power to kill you. And it should really come as no surprise that this particular government operation makes a lot of mistakes. And for me, the strongest argument against capital punishment as a legal system is the problem of innocence. No matter how hard we try, no matter how much money states are willing to pump into a criminal justice system, a capital punishment system, people make mistakes, and judges are people, juries are people, and by a very conservative estimate, there have been 122 exonerations under modern current capital punishment statutes. Now, 122 exonerations, there have now been 1,004 executions, which means that roughly for every 9 executions, there's been an exoneration. And I want to be clear about what I mean by exoneration. Someone who is absolutely, totally, 100% innocent. They got the wrong guy. They simply convicted and sentenced to death the wrong person. Has happened 122 times under these modern, relatively well-funded, well-financed capital punishment statutes. Issues of race and class, in my experience, also really can't be separated from capital punishment as a legal system, what I like to call the real capital punishment. Capital punishment as a legal system is hopelessly warped by matters of class, and at least in the South, which is where most of my experience with capital punishment has been, also warped by matters of race. Now, one could, and I think it's fair to characterize these concerns, innocence, class, race, and the like, as moral issues. It seems to me profoundly immoral to tolerate a system that we know has, will, and will always send innocent people to death row and execute them. It seems to me immoral to tolerate a system under which the decision of who lives and who dies is based not nearly so much as on the crime or is on the criminal, but is based on the quality of defense lawyering the person receives at trial and on appeal and in the state and federal post-conviction processes. Those seem to be moral argument against capital punishment. But in terms of what I think most folks think of as moral arguments opposing capital punishment, I have never heard or read a convincing moral, religious, philosophical argument against capital punishment. I'm not a pacifist, for example. I believe that the state, the government, has the right, and in certain limited circumstances, just wars, for example, the state has the moral obligation to kill in self-defense. And I haven't come up with a way of getting from that assumption to a conclusion that if the state can, consistent with morality, kill external enemies in self-defense, why that same state can't, with equal moral force, turn own citizens in domestic self-defense.
Well, among the many arguments that I have heard from people who are against the death penalty, another thing that seems to come up fairly often is they will say that it actually costs, in terms of financial costs, it costs the state more to execute someone than it does to keep them on death row. And because I admittedly don't know that much about it, I've wondered if that is a sort of folk myth or is that really accurate? Do you know about that particular issue?
It is absolutely accurate. And going back to the statement that I submitted to the New Hampshire legislature 5 years ago, I focus really on only two issues, innocence and cost. And those two issues are very related in my mind, because the quality of justice that you get depends in large measure on how much money you're willing to put into it. There really aren't absolutely precise numbers on how much executions cost and how much versus how much life imprisonment without possibility of parole costs. But in general, study after study after study has found that capital punishment costs millions of dollars more per execution than life imprisonment without possibility of parole. For my money, the best study is one that's now a few years old. It was David Vondrelli did it in the Miami Herald newspaper back in, I think it was May of 1988, estimated $4.3 million more to execute a death row prisoner than it costs to incarcerate them for the rest of their lives. And there are a variety of reasons why that's the case. But for me, I think the bottom line is lawyers cost more than prison guards. And unless we are going to radically limit appeals, and which in turn would greatly increase the always present, omnipresent risk of executing the innocent, that's the connection in my mind between the cost issue and the innocence issue, you're going to get a fairly direct trade-off, it seems to me. So it's counterintuitive. And it's an issue, the cost issue is actually one that I'm kind of a latecomer in coming to. Cost was an issue that I never used to like talking about or making that argument, because it always felt weird to me to be making a dollar and cents argument when the issue on the table is whether my government ought to be in the business of killing people.
Right.
But when your audience is a legislature, especially a legislature like the Vermont legislature next month or the New Hampshire legislature back in 2000, that's an audience that has got to take cost into consideration in a very big way. And I have always thought that if there was a way to document how much a capital prosecution, which went all the way and resulted in an actual execution in New Hampshire, would cost versus a guilty plea or even a non-capital trial, we would have been able to persuade even Gene Shaheen back in 2000 to sign the abolition bill. And those are probably going to be the two main arguments that I'm going to be making in the Vermont legislature next month, the interconnected issues of innocence and cost, and the practical fiscal reality in states like Vermont and New Hampshire that don't have a lot of spare cash to be spending on symbolic programs. And the idea that the Vermont legislature would divert money, and we're talking a lot of money, millions and millions of dollars every year for as long as capital punishment stays on the books here. That's all money, dollar for dollar, you're taking away from heating subsidies for poor people, school funding, cops on the beat, prosecutors, investigators, DNA testing. I mean, once you really get into the nitty-gritty, the how much capital punishment costs at each step and each stage in the process, the practical argument for abolition or against reinstatement really becomes pretty powerful, it seems to me. And that's the case that I hope to help put on in Montpelier in the Vermont State House in January.
Do you see a day coming when the death penalty is abolished throughout the U.S., or do you think that that would involve enough of a cultural change? And by that I mean, you know, a certain percentage of the population that occasionally we've been called a culture of violence or revenge. Is that something that just isn't likely to happen in the years to come?
There's no doubt in my mind that at some point America will join most of the rest of the world that we consider civilized in rejecting and reject capital punishment. And in fact, I like a lot of the trend lines that I see on this issue. Public opinion is still majority in favor of capital punishment, but by smaller majorities than was the case even a few years ago. The high point, I think, was in the mid-90s, around 80%. It's now down to around 64%. And that 64%, if the only question you ask is, are you for or against capital punishment? Throw in life imprisonment without possibility of parole as an alternative, and the number drops below 50%. Death sentencing rates across the country have declined, and in some instances declined pretty dramatically over the past few years. One of the things that makes 2005, I think, a milestone year in capital punishment is the numbers came out in 2005 from death sentences in the year before in 2004, and the numbers are dramatically down. Juries are much less willing to return death sentences today than they were even a few years ago. Numbers of executions haven't changed very much. There were 60 executions in 2005, 59 in 2004. But it's way too soon to conclude that America right now is on the path to abolition, that we've turned some sort of metaphorical corner and that it's now only a matter of time. There are so many variables that come into play that we can't quantify, that we can't even really identify with anything close to scientific precision. But the sense that I get is that America's taking a step back from capital punishment. And really the only two exceptions have been, that I can see at least, have been the Ashcroft Justice Department and the federal death penalty, and the Vermont legislature taking up a capital punishment reinstatement bill in a serious way in January. I mean, ironically, right when the rest of the country seems to be stepping back from capital punishment and is reconsidering it, Vermont seems to be considering moving in the opposite direction.
Well, in the few minutes that we have remaining, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the resources that are out there for those who would like to read up some more on the death penalty debate and issue, including you have a number of books, Dead Wrong, A Death Row Lawyer Speaks Out Against Capital Punishment. What sort of reading would you recommend people do if they want to know some more about this issue?
The single best resource, I think, actually is the Death Penalty Information Center website, which I think is deathpenaltyinfo.org. They really have become the leading collector of empirical information about capital punishment. And they just published their death penalty in 2005 year-end report that gives all the numbers and the statistical breakdowns. There are literally scores of really first-rate books about every aspect of capital punishment. My two favorites, I think, are David Vondrelli's 1995 book, Among the Lowest of the Dead, which focuses on Florida as a case study in America's modern experience with capital punishment. And the other book I would recommend is actually a novel called Conviction by Richard North Patterson that really does a wonderful job of evaluating and describing the process and the obstacles faced by death row lawyers, even when we are trying to raise claims of actual innocence, of factual innocence. The Richard North Patterson book, Conviction, has a chillingly accurate and profoundly depressingly accurate account of the 1996 Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, which for all intents and purposes, shut down federal judicial review, federal habeas corpus review for large classes and categories of death row claims, including claims of factual innocence.
I would like to give you a chance to talk a little bit about some of the things that you've written as well. Another one of those books being The Wrong Man, A True Story of Innocence on Death Row, about Crazy Joe Spaziano. Can you tell us a little bit about that particular one?
Crazy Joe Spaziano was my one client over the years who I absolutely knew with 100% certainty. I knew in my bone marrow that he was innocent. He, as it turned out, was my first capital client when I first started working as a capital public defender in Florida. His was the first case file that my boss walked into my office and plopped down on my desk my first day of work. And I ended up representing him on and off from then, the fall of 1983 until actually the fall of 1995, when he came within just a few days of being executed for crimes that I know he didn't commit. And it wasn't anything that I did as his lawyer or that the courts did that saved his life in 1995. It rather was the intervention of a strongly pro-capital punishment newspaper, the Miami Herald, who jumped into his case, did a bit of investigative reporting, and was able to persuade the state's star witness to finally, after at that time close to 20 years, turning around and telling the truth. And it was, I mentioned a moment ago when I was talking about the Richard North Patterson book, and one of the things I liked about that book was it shows the obstacles that defense lawyers confront when they're trying to persuade courts to really take a look at and consider newly discovered evidence of innocence. And in Joe's case, back in 95, it actually took a little act of civil disobedience on my part to nudge the Florida Supreme Court into granting a stay of execution to give us enough time to put on an evidentiary hearing before a Florida trial judge on or newly discovered evidence of innocence, which really was the Miami Herald's newly discovered evidence of innocence, which when we finally had the opportunity to do that, the judge threw out the conviction, threw out the death sentence, and unfortunately, Joe is still in prison. He's not on death row, but he's still in prison on an unrelated rape charge, unrelated rape conviction, which it turns out the state of Florida used the same perjurious witness, the same lying witness, to frame him for the rape case as they used to frame him for the murder case and send him to death row for nearly two decades and five death warrants. So this time every year, actually, every Hanukkah and Christmas and New Year's, I write Joe a letter, and I've been doing this since 1983. I send him a letter, the thrust of which is, hopefully next year, my friend, will be the year that we'll be able to walk you out of Florida State Prison a free man, but we're not quite there yet.
And again, the name of that book by Michael Mello about Crazy Joe Spaziano is The Wrong Man, A True Story of Innocence on Death Row. A couple of others that he has written, Dead Wrong, A Death Row Lawyer Speaks Out Against Capital Punishment, and Death Work, Defending the Condemned. Michael Mello is a professor of law at Vermont Law School in South Royalton, Vermont. Professor Mello, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Anytime. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks, Tom, for that interview. You're listening to Making Waves. Now we hear from someone with another perspective on this issue, Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has spent the last 23 years on death row.
Harold's Long Walk from Death Row. The name Harold Wilson doesn't ring many bells, at least not yet. That's because neither his conviction nor his exoneration has led to many headlines. And other than his family, people in his Philadelphia neighborhood, or folks on death row, his name was a cipher, virtually unknown, until now. In mid-November 2005, Harold Wilson walked away from prison and away from the long horrors of Pennsylvania's death row after a Philadelphia jury fully acquitted him of not one, not two, but three counts of first-degree murder. Convicted back in 1989, Wilson spent nearly a decade on death row before a lower court threw out his death sentence for ineffectiveness of counsel. It would take 4 more years until his new trial was granted because the DA used unfair and unconstitutional methods to choose his first trial jury. The Philadelphia prosecutor violated the Batson rule by improperly removing blacks from his jury. Surprisingly, the DA didn't appeal his new trial ruling. It would take several long, torturous years, but in late 2005, a full and fair jury decided what it took 16 years to prove, that Harold C. Wilson was not guilty, and thus he was acquitted. According to the Death Penalty Information Center, Wilson became the 122nd person found to have been wrongfully and erroneously convicted, sent to death row, and freed, released from prison. What led to his liberation was DNA evidence which showed that blood on items said to have connected him to the crime scene didn't come from any of the victims, nor Wilson himself. What a difference a jury makes. Wilson's freedom, coming as it did just days before the legalized lynching of the late Stanley Tukey Williams, shows us that just because one was convicted doesn't mean one is guilty. Harold could easily still be encaged to the bitter confines of Pennsylvania's death row if some little things happened differently. That's because the DA has held that the jury error could be traced to one bad apple instead of the entire office. The DA who recorded a video learning tape for new DAs told them essentially how to get around the U.S. Supreme Court's 1986 Batson versus Kentucky decision by using hook or crook, by lying to the judge, by feigning illness, all tactics to be used to find ways to exclude blacks from jury participation. He decried black jurors who were from North Philly, especially black women, and only found one or two blacks, preferably old or from the South, would be acceptable. That prosecutor was Harold's prosecutor, and for that reason it was difficult to deny his Batson issue. But of course, that wasn't the only case in which such tactics were used. Indeed, in the Batson decision itself, the late Justice Thurgood Marshall pointed to several cases from Pennsylvania which argued that it was perfectly acceptable to kick blacks off of juries. And as we have seen, even after Batson, Philadelphia prosecutors have sought to find creative and unique ways to craft all-white or predominantly white juries by striking blacks off. 16 years in the dungeons of death row to hear the words he should have heard in 1989, not guilty. What does this say about the system? That it's slow, but it works? How do you repay 16 years in hell? Harold Wilson takes a long-awaited walk to freedom. In a truly fair system, he should never have been caged in the first place. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, author of We Want Freedom, A Life in the Black Panther Party.
These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.